Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you all for joining us today for the New Irish Fiction panel at the Bay Area Book Festival. Before we begin, I want to do two things and ask you, if you have not yet, to silence your cell phones, and also to thank the sponsor for today's event, which is Culture Ireland. That organization has brought our writers here today, and we have a representative. Catherine Barry is here somewhere from Culture Ireland Bay Area. And I just wanted to mention that they are putting on a wonderful, if you're interested in Ireland and Irish literature, there's a relatively new, it'll be its second year, but Los Gatos Listol Irish Writers Week will be happening in October. So you can get information about that here today. Our session will go until 11:15, and we're going to talk a little bit up here. Hopefully, my role will mostly be to get our guests talking to you and with each other. And at about 11 o'clock, I'll open it up, and if you have questions for them, that would be great. My name is Rosemary Graham. I live here in Berkeley, and I teach at St. Mary's College of California. For the last 6 years, I've had the great privilege and pleasure of taking groups of students to Ireland in the winter, in January. We travel all around the country. I'm very excited to have these writers with us here today. We have Colin Barrett, who is sitting at the end of the table there. He's the author of the short story collection Young Skins. His work has also, you might have read his work in The New Yorker, Granta, and other literary journals. Paul Murray is the author of three novels, An Evening of Long Goodbyes, Skippy Dies, and most recently, The Mark and the Void. And John Toomey is also a novelist with three books, Sleepwalker, Huddleston Road, and Slipping. And I've asked them, our program copy asks a few questions. And why does the small rocky island of Ireland have such an outsized influence on world literature? Who is coming along in the footsteps of the names that we all know? What news do they have of Ireland? And I asked our writers if they would introduce themselves today with that last question, what news do they have of Ireland? And I left it to them to interpret however they want, but I thought it would be a great way for them to read a little bit from their work as a starting point. And so, Colin, alphabetically.
Yes.
What news do you have of Ireland?
Well, I don't live there anymore, so...
Ah, well.
I live in Toronto. For actress Taoiseach, yeah. No, we moved 4 months ago, so I'm actually getting the exilic experience. I'm living abroad, so... I don't have any news of Ireland. I'm really sorry. I mean, I miss it, but, you know, but...
could you read some from your... about Ireland?
Sure, yeah. It's all set in Ireland. It's not only...
Yes,
it's
right.
All set in Mayo,
tell
basically.
Us a little bit of...
I'm just going to write about Mayo for the rest of my life. It's about 44,000 people in the county, so I think I can do them all before I die. Write like 50 books. I'll just read... sorry to be unenlightening about the news from Ireland, but I do genuinely not live there anymore. So I'll just read just the opening of a story I've been working on. It's... not in this collection, because this collection is like 2 years old, and I have done some work in between then, but this story's called The Alps. In the parking lot of the... and it's just the start of it. In the parking lot of the Ballyhadrine Gales Football Club, the three brothers known as The Alps removed themselves from the eldest Rory's piebald-panelled Hitachi Hi-Ace. Rory slammed shut the van's side door, and the brothers moved off across the moonscape of the lot in order of their conceptions. Rory on point, the middle brother Eustace close behind, and the youngest Bimbo in dawdling tow. The Alps, weary after a week of work, did not speak. They listened to the chunked slippage of the gravel under their work boots. On the floodlit pitch, a pheasant was grooming itself in the goal mouth. The night air was warm and sultry with the smell of summer silage. The Alps liked a quiet drink of a Friday night. The Ballyhadrine Gales clubhouse bar was a reliably subdued spot. Asleep almost on his feet, Bimbo saw a light moving in the dark of the sky. A shining point, minuscule as a star or a transatlantic plane, but moving far too nimbly and erratically. Bimbo roused. He watched the point descend at a diagonal, shoot back up at 90 degrees, then stop and sort of wobble in place in the night sky. A spaceship, Bimbo fancifully thought, for the point's motion, however clumsy, seemed purposeful. Then Bimbo noticed a patch of land the pip of light appeared to be bobbing above and figured it out. "See that," he said. "Ha," Eustace said. "What I'm looking at," Bimbo said. His older brothers turned, looked at Bimbo, then faced back in the direction he was looking. "Which would be what?" Rory said. "See," Bimbo said, focusing his attention on the point in the sky, and as if by telepathy, the older two duly clocked the light. "What in the Christ is that when it's at home?" Eustace said. "It's a drone," Bimbo said. "Because them acres over there belong to Marcus Landry, right? And that man only went and imported half a dozen of those things in from the States. He uses them to keep track of his herds, is what it is." "Drones," Rory said. "Would you be well? He's rakes of land and rakes of livestock, but animals do be regularly going missing on him," Bimbo said. "The surmise would be that some intrepid whore is poaching them on him." "That would be the surmise, all right," Rory said. "Drones," Eustace said. "Would you be well?" Rory said. "Landry is a man of means," Eustace said. "Men of means are rarely right in the head." "Surveillance," Bimbo said. "I think it's cool."
Agricultural Ireland and Silicon Valley technology in that story.
They're everywhere now, drones in Ireland, that's my news, yeah.
Paul, would you introduce yourself and read us a little bit?
Yep. It's terribly early. I don't think there's ever been a reading at 10 a.m. in Ireland.
They've ended it.
Certainly not on a Sunday.
So thank you for coming. I don't have news either. The news in Ireland is all Trump. Like, everyone's just obsessed with Trump. So that's the news. So I'm just going to read a short bit from this book, which is Ireland has reinvented itself in recent years as a tax haven. The government don't like you to call it a tax haven, but when Apple... You may have read the news that Apple has now capitalized at $800 billion. And part of that is because they funnel a lot of their profits through Ireland, and they pay 0.005% tax. It's just really interesting that this kind of small country that sort of prides itself on, like, this notion of, like, authenticity and greenness and just people being just kind of sound is just the center of this, like, international chicanery. It's like a chicanery HQ. It's all in the QT, which is something that Ireland are very good at, Irish people. So I'm just going to read a little bit. So the book, it's narrated by a French investment banker called Claude, and he's been approached by an Irish writer called Paul. And this guy, Paul, wants to find out about the world of banking because he wants to understand the banking crash that sort of almost sank the island, so he can write a novel about it. And Claude is very excited because he feels like this is going to give his life some sort of validation and meaning. He gets the sense that Paul has been sort of shadowing him around his bank for a week, and he gets the sense that Paul is not quite happy with what he's finding. When the writer, I'm not going to do Claude's French accent, but he's speaking in a French accent. When the writer arrives at the office next morning, he is not alone. A man is with him, a great hulking creature, almost 7 foot tall, with a sloping forehead and brawny knotted forearms that extend from an ill-fitting nylon shirt. Paul introduces him as Igor Struma, poet, professor of contemporary art, and member of the celebrated Vladivostok Circle. "He's going to be helping me with some of the more conceptual stuff," Paul explains. "What exactly this means, I'm not sure, but for the rest of the day, instead of observing me and my colleagues, the two of them spend their time muttering in secluded corners or slinking around the office, making inscrutable gestures, knocking on walls, poking at ceiling tiles, tracing with their fingers mysterious vectors from the floor behind computers up to the power supply. I have a bad feeling about this Igor. One cannot say what a poet ought to look like, of course, any more than one can say what a murderer ought to look like, but he definitely looks more like a murderer than a poet. He smells bad in several different ways at once, like curdled milk in a public lavatory. And when I type his name into the search engine, a red virus warning sign flashes immediately up onto the screen. Later that day, Paul invites me to the cafe for lunch with his helpmeet nowhere to be seen. I thought I should fill you in a little on Igor's role, he says, as the waitress guides us to a table. You're probably wondering what he's doing here. I'm writing the book. You're the subject. What am I doing bringing a third party into it? I make a stock gesture of innocence as if the thought had never crossed my mind. The fact is that while the romantic image is of the writer working away in solitude, it's often much more of a collaborative activity. Every writer has his strengths and weaknesses. It's quite common to draft in a colleague to help with elements you're less sure about. I've heard about such practices in other art forms, but I confess I had not encountered it in literature before. Kind of a trade secret, Paul says. Well, can you give me an example? An example? Well, I suppose the most famous partnership would be J.R.R. Tolkien and Ian Fleming. Really? Oh, yes. When Tolkien was putting Lord of the Rings together, he was great at working at, you know, the ancestral background of the elves and so forth, but in terms of plot, he was hopeless. So he brought in someone who did know about plot, his old friend Ian Fleming, creator of James Bond. The whole magic ring thing was Fleming's idea. In the original version, Tolkien was just going to have the hobbits and the elves reciting poems to each other. I didn't know that, I say. Yeah, similarly, Tolstoy, when he was writing War and Peace, found the peace parts no problem, but really got stuck when it came to war, so he got in touch with an up-and-coming young naval officer called Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill co-wrote War and Peace. Little bits here and there, details. Like I say, writers generally prefer not to talk about it. And what is Igor's specialism? Places. He's a master. Big places, small places, indoors, outdoors, he can do mountain ranges and lakes. He could write you a paragraph about a broom cupboard that'd have you bawling your eyes out. I suppose you could say he's got an intuitive grasp of structure, which you feel has evaded you in the bank, I say. Exactly. It's an unfamiliar environment, to be frank, not one that readily yields up its inner poetry. So I thought, okay, time to call in the expert. I'll stop there. Thank you.
And John to me.
Hi, good morning. It's interesting to hear that the guys read theirs. Mine is nothing like either of them. Mine is a story about a man who murdered his wife, and he's also a school teacher as I am. And so it is not autobiographical, and yet it is. So I'll let you decide. But I'm actually reading from what is these. There's a prologue, and there's a type of prologue in the second chapter. But I'm starting the second chapter because this is the story is told by the killer himself. I think the first part of the book is kind of comic until he actually murders his wife, and then it's hard to be funny. And then we get into a situation looking at what really happened and what went through his mind. So the part I'm going to read is his opening, statement in custody and his telling of what happened on the day. So it begins on the morning of the murder. It wasn't that I didn't love her. I tell you that for sure, with full certainty. There was too much love, perhaps, or love too pure, but it was not a matter of love's absence. So where to begin, then? That morning, I suppose, although there was much more to it, you understand. Asking where a story begins is like asking where time began. There's always further back again. But since it must begin, let it be like so. I lay awake beside her, just before the inching break of dawn, facing her sleepy contours, listening to her breathe, a beautiful voiceless sound, her lungs heaving gently inward, her dark humps swelling and dipping, like something oceanic. Yes, that'll do nicely, won't it? Come the morning, in fussy daylight, milk splashed over the cereal and her spoon clinked on the bowl, chipping excruciatingly at the silence. I sipped tea, careful not to slurp, and read, my finger held at 2 inches from the tip of my nose, moving cursorily from left to right across the grey expanse of the morning paper, concentration straining to win out over interruption. Her voice was not typically musical, but was capable, nonetheless, of lulling me to contentment through familiarity and distant intimacy. More tea, any toast across on my love, darling, sweetheart, and so on and so forth. But not this morning. A shake of the head, and another. If only she could leave it there. But she persisted, as she always did. Persistence defined her. A smile and a shake of my head. Still more persistence, that soon became insistence. Finally, I was compelled to speak. And so I did, to castrate that compulsion of hers to provide. "No, honestly, I'm fine," I said. I hoped this was us done and I could return to my soundproof mind. But she had more words to share with me, more words to which I hardly listened. 4 o'clock, darling. What's that?" I asked, trying to collect and disregard in one. "Damn it," I exclaimed, inwardly, and perhaps a little outwardly. The day had begun without my consent. 4 o'clock, my appointment. Should be home by 5:30, at the latest," she said. Dressed, I turned my shoulder to the audience of the mirror. Nice, I thought. Lean legs, the shoeshine glint of my black shoes. I patted my stomach, taut and spare, and permitted my reflection a satisfied smile. Tidy enough, well preserved, and that's none too shabby at 49. I have not fallen to slovenliness, as most men do. At 10.5 stone and 1/2 inch below 6 foot, there are worse than me. Evading repulsiveness is in itself a success at a certain age. I shuffled the loose sheets of notes I prepared into a neatly symmetrical block and slid them between a history and English textbook, held secure and protected from fraying and rumpling. With 2 exterior buckles, I then secured the bag and left the house. 1 stride became 2, then 3, and so on, until my feet had grown full and purposeful. For 25 years, I have followed the same route each morning of each weekday of term time. There were periods when I drove and another when I cycled, and then, recently, I began walking. But the route that I walk daily is the same route travelled all my working life, winding in and around the estate, 1 mile down the coast road into town, through it and beyond, to the school complex at the far side. I had been walking months before Val wondered what had come over me. What strange impulse was this, she asked, to begin walking to work at the age of 49? It wasn't what a man of my vintage ought to be doing. Or, if you're to insist on it, you should invest in a smart overcoat and a briefcase, she said. That god-awful leather satchel of yours is spilling over with books and papers, Al. Have you no pride? The weight of the satchel causes me to heave and creak, like some lamed farmhand from an awful Steinbeck novel, Val enjoys saying. And I like the literary reference. It is her tiny acknowledgement of who I am, of my passions and talents and taste. That I'm not too pushed on Steinbeck either hardly matters. What worsens the folly of my walking is that on a couple of evenings I've arrived home soaked through, with dense globules of rain gathered and congealed at the cuffs of my woolen suit, dangling and plummeting to the doormat, as I step inside the porch, beaming like a child who has spent the afternoon jumping in mud. "Sweet mother of our Lord, Albert, what has you walking to work again? Take the car, would you, or buy a bloody umbrella," she said on one of those evenings. "An umbrella, yes," I responded. "Why the walking anyway, Al? Having an affair or something? Should I be checking your drawers for new underwear? Some young belle on staff, maybe, fawning over your aloof angularity?" She was irritable that evening. "An affair, Val? Now that would be something," I said, engaged, back in regular time again. "An affair? An affair?" We both laughed. That's it.
You guys can answer this question any way, or take it up any way you want. What is it about the small, rocky island? How has Ireland made you writers, kept you writing? Anyone?
I think there is something in the culture that reveres or views writing as worthy, and that maybe kind of enables more people to do it. I don't necessarily mean things that we read more. I think we all talk about our Joyces and Becketts, but I can't find a single person in my circle of friends who's read Joyce or Beckett. But I think there exists within a certain reverence towards literature that makes people perhaps to view it as worthy, and that itself possibly produces people who want to do it.
I think loads of people have read Joyce and Beckett. It's like for a long time, writing was the only thing that Ireland was good at. Like it was literally the only thing that we were good at. So people were very proud of it. I guess, yeah, it was just, it's just something that, like, it's very cheap to do, you know. So like, you know, anyone can set themselves up as a writer with like a very, very low kind of initial investment, which is quite attractive as well. My dad was taught Irish literature, so our house was always just full of books, and it just felt like a natural thing for me to do. He was horrified when I became said I was going to be a writer. Recently, my son, who's 5, told me he was going to become a writer, and I nearly choked on my dinner. Over my dead body, will you become a writer? It's very strange. Like I can only kind of surmise, to use Colin's word, like that. It's just because it's in the ether. It's just because it's part of the conversation. And because I guess it's a very verbal country where people talk all the time, and there's a real premium set on talking and being funny or entertaining, whatever it might be, that sort of filters down into... have you a better theory than that? Or?
No. I don't know. It'd be kind of... people would give it a go, at some point in their life, maybe. I don't know. But I'm 35 now, and this book was published when I was, 30, I can't remember, memory's brutal, it's about 3 years ago, but until I was about like 26 or 27, I'd never met a writer, and I'd wanted to be a writer since I was 15 or something. But even when I was in college, around the turn of the millennium, there was hardly any kind of creative writing courses, and so there wasn't much of an infrastructure academically, in the way that there is now. And there wasn't, I don't know how Irish publishing, what state it was in then. It's pretty healthy at the moment, in terms of there's a genuine interest to find new writers. I suppose the country's small enough that you can, literally, if you want to meet writers, it never occurred to me till I was about 27, I went to a magazine launch or something and met people who were writing and wanted to write, but until then I'd never had a meaningful conversation about it with anyone else. But then it was there, it doesn't, the country's small enough that you can kind of go, if you want to go to Cork in Galway, and you live in Dublin, it's 2 hours on a bus, and so but as to why, I don't know. I mean, we have the English language, but we are allowed to mess around with it more than I did have a conversation once with an editor in the UK, and he was just kind of saying, he's like, what? He was asking the same questions, like, why are there so many good Irish writers now, why are there so many young ones out, why are there so many. And he just said he didn't find the same experience in the UK, like with writers from England and stuff. There wasn't any kind of sense of a scene or a wave coming through in the last few years. I don't know. I think we're just allowed to be a bit feral with the language or something, in a way that, people who go to Oxford just, I don't know, I think they get ruined. when it comes to writing, and being a bit stylistically, risky or something,
It's kind of a culture of renegades as well. Like, I think there's a lot of, historically, Ireland has always been under the thumb of someone or other, from elsewhere. And that's sort of produced, most people will just kind of get their heads down and get on with it. But there's always kind of outliers, strange, angry renegades who will what was the thing in the olden days? There was a famous thing, the bards of Ireland had this thing where they'd curse you. Do you know what those called? This thing? It was a very bad thing. So the poets...
Oh, the magpies?
There was a thing called, was it a gyas, I think it was called. The bards were these kind of strange figures who were sort of both inside and outside the court. They were sort of, they worked for the king, and they'd write great songs about the chief and so forth, but they didn't fully belong to the chieftain or the king, whoever it was. And if the king crossed them, then they'd curse him. And that was really, really bad. If you got cursed by one of these bards, you were sort of bunched after that. And I think that sort of sense that, I think there's still a sense, or up until recently, there was still a sense that writing had some sort of, was a kind of like counterforce that to challenge or to kind of fight these kind of very monolithic forces that were kind of crushing the country at various points, all points of its history.
Is it still the case? I mean, I teach English literature. I teach English majors, though not all of my students are literature majors. I teach in some general education courses, you know, and you worry, and I know John teaches also, you worry sometimes about whether with the technology, whether the young people are going to stay reading. So I'm wondering if anyone has any, maybe ask John that about are young Irish people now, are you raising good readers still in spite of everything else?
They certainly don't read as extensively, maybe as previous generations. And it is easier, I suppose, easier to pick up your iPad and watch a movie than it is to read a book. But there's not any, in my sort of experience, like I look at the guys I teach, and I suppose the guys are doing their leaving set, cert, they're 18. And for the guy in a class of 26, 27, I'll have, you know, five or six for whom English is their subject, you know. And they're much better workers than I ever was when I was 18. I would view them as certainly more talented than me as well. So it's not a lack, it's not that there's anything different in this generation, but it is perhaps that they aren't reading as much. But the guys who want to do it, and I would imagine that one more word, the lads here, there's maybe, you know, it was always a small select group of people, so it doesn't need to be
right.
A big group of people. You know, five or six in a class of 26 and they're interested. I wonder, was it any ever different? I've no way to tell that. But I don't think, I don't view it that way. I think there will always be, you know, a need for certain people to write. I think Philip Roth talked about that, you know, about the idea it's not the writer that's going to die, it's the readership. And that's, you know, I think some people will always want to write, and it's whether there's readers out there for you. But I think for most people who write, you know, in some level you might not be able to do it as a profession, but in some level you would probably do it anyway. You know, even if nobody's kind of, because I don't know what the lad's experiences either were, but I certainly, on each of the three books I wrote, not knowing when I started writing whether anybody was going to publish it at all. So, you know, to invest kind of 3-4 years into it, not knowing that, there has to be something else going on. So, look, I think there will still be writers and the things are still coming out. I still see guys who are interested in shaping their sentences and expressing things with energy and conviction. But there are more distractions, and it's easier to do a lot of other things than it is to write.
One thing that did change was when there was an economic boom in Ireland between like 97 and 2006, regrettably called the Celtic Tiger. It was great in many ways for a certain period of time, and it was quite strange in other ways, because the country got very, very rich very, very quickly. It went from being like a real sort of backwater that people just left to being this kind of the most globalized country in the world, we're constantly being told. And one strange consequence of that was that, a general thing was that people suddenly stopped acting Irish and tried to sort of act international. So like everyone was wearing sunglasses, you know, which you rarely need in Ireland, or buying a convertible, the same thing. Like it's just a total waste of money.
Drinking lattes.
Yeah. Drinking lattes, that kind of thing.
Trying to eat food outside. Trying to eat food outside in Ireland, you're lost on yourself. Yeah. It doesn't matter how sunny it is, the breeze will just take your salad
seagulls,
and into the ground. Yeah.
Seagulls that will come
big
down.
Big pigeon the size of a dog will fucking try and eat your croissant.
A barge will come and take. But one kind of weird consequence of that was that like books, which had always been, as I said, like this kind of thing, the only thing that we were good at, books became part of like old Ireland, which everyone was suddenly trying to flee. So, so weirdly, for that kind of period between like roughly sort of like the early 2000s, to kind of stop being new writers, like when Colin's like generation came along, that was when Ireland had crashed. And suddenly there was all these new writers, like really exciting, really talented people. But for a period of about sort of 6 or 7 years, there was just nobody. And the reason was that one reason was you could get a job, you know, and you could get a, which is like, as we all know, the enemy of art. And also the place is getting really expensive, so it was, you sort of had to get a job, you know. But also I kind of wonder if it was because. Just it was sort of like it was a time when the country was like had sort of stopped being introspective or stopped being reflective, and it was just more about just, you know, how can we accumulate, you know, there was nothing sort of nothing about a book says like you can't show off with a book, like, you know, it's not like having a like eating your lunch outside and like, oh, there's that guy's doing well, so. So, but do you know what I mean? Like, so that was it was a very strange period, and I'm glad. I mean, it was the crash when it came was very destructive, but it did have this wonderful effect of people kind of came back to books and came back to writing, and now there's like every time you turn around, there's like some new like brilliant kid. It's yeah. Sort of horrible for me because, but it's great in general for art.
I just now it's funny you say that, because like I would have thought the same, and I was kind of thinking about this a little bit this morning about that. There was that kind of period of I would have thought maybe it was a little bit longer than 6 or 7, maybe 8 or 9, where nobody seemed to be coming, and now all of a sudden, you know, off the top of your head, you, even though I might not know them, might not have read all the work, you can name 8-10 young-ish Irish writers that are there. But I'd actually be a bit more like within an educational sphere. There's a real push against humanities and arts. Like there's like things like in your Leaving Cert, you get more points for doing maths, and the education at the moment is responding to industry, and industry needs engineers. So therefore, and some of the exams, they've been changing exams in the Irish system, and in my view, like the new change to what the juniors are, is going to actually, it's killing the subject. It's to, what they're doing to it is terrible, and that would be a bit worrying, because I think I don't think the education system itself is the primary thing for a writer. I think it comes from somewhere else. But you're introducing some people who are on those outliers. Sometimes it's a teacher in school who introduces them to something. Like, oh, this is good. But actually, it's been quite marginalised within education, literature in particular, but the arts and humanities in general has been pushed aside as in favour of satisfying the industry of other industries that are out there. So I'd be kind of I'm a little concerned about that direction. But at the same time, I do think that people who write and make music and paint, and I think it comes from somewhere else. Like, I don't think the system produces them at the same time. So.
No. No, I don't read much. I was just thinking of, there's a he died last year, a cultural critic, a British one, Mark Fisher, his name is. He wrote a great book called Capital Realism. It's a really short book. You can get it online. And it's just about the capital realism. There is no alternative. He worked in the... he teached in uni, he's a lecturer, and he's great and very funny on all that sort of stuff. But he had a good point. He said in England in the 80s there was an equivalent, except it was in music, so the punk, post-punk, new wave bands, and he said there was this great flowering, he says, since the mid-80s. Now, it could just be because he was a middle-aged man and stopped listening to young bands, but he was like, you know, music has not developed in England or anywhere else for the last 10, 15 years or whatever. This was his thesis. But he just said there was such a creative flowering then in the 80s, because basically back then it wasn't as prohibitively expensive to go to school, to go to art college. So the working class kids could go to uni, and it, you know, they didn't have to go into debt. They get a government grant. Most of them would just use that to buy equipment and start making a record. And but it was, he just said it was a great. And there's something, I think there's something akin to that with the recession. There was a lot of students who, I mean, Ireland, again, like everywhere else, the cost of education is going up. But I mean, you don't have to go massively into debt, you know, to go to college. And so you don't have the sort of, there's not the same, I don't know what you'd say. There's not the same. Like, there are a lot of young Irish writers, you know, coming up. It is a great moment for it. But they can take their time. They're not in debt, so they can be unemployed or they can have a job somewhere for a while, you know. And there's not the same insane pressure to sort of professionalize yourself as quickly as possible. As obviously when you meet maybe a lot of young American writers, if they're doing MFAs, they're in Columbia or something, they're, you know, going insane. And because, you know, it's cost so much and it's been so pressurized. And so it's just a perverse thing, I think. Just you can get what support you can from the education system. You come to university, read books in the library, and sort of get exposed, go to literary events or whatever. But you're not. It's as Paul said, it's not expensive to do, and it's not expensive to live that way. And I mean, I spent a large chunk of my 20s either unemployed or, you know, whatever, and I was just writing, and, you know, it was just about doable. You know, no money was fine, and. And I know a lot of younger writers are sort of in that zone. So once that goes, that, you know, once third level education cuts off a certain section of people, I think, you know, or effectively does, it's never good for the culture long term. You see the effects down the line. So hopefully it won't happen in Ireland. But
it's interesting to hear that about the. I don't entirely understand the leading cert and how that all works, but I have some idea. And I was in Ireland 2 summers ago when, you know, the results were coming out and every newspaper was full of it and every family was on edge. And then the night they came out, we saw them in the pub celebrating their son's results. But to hear that structurally, I mean, that the government, you know, so in my line of work, I have to, or what I try to do is tell people who are considering majoring in English, as we call it here, that you know, because they're coming in with, and they're absolutely going to be leaving the institution with debt. That's how we do it. And so their parents very reasonably are asking them, if you study literature, what are you going to do with that? And so we do a lot to try to, we bring in all our successful English majors. We got our university magazine to write an article. It's called From Shakespeare to Silicon Valley. And we have, you know, pictures.
Good Lord.
I know. And, you know, I cringed, and yet I was glad. I'm glad to have that to show my students, to show their parents, I can study literature and I can be employable. But it's tricky. It's really,
Yeah, no, I remember a documentary years ago about Morrissey, the lead singer of the Smiths, and he was just, again, in the early 80s. British band, for anyone who doesn't know them. And they just they were just chatting to him, and they go, you know, I finished school and everyone was saying you have to go get a job, and I just said I don't want one. And, you know, that's heretical now, you can't say that.
Yeah. Right.
Well, he could, and he was just on the door for a bit, and he, you know, got the band together and went off and made great art for the best part of his life. But yeah, it's just, you can't do that anymore. You go to college to get a job. It's not to learn anymore. So
it's sad because I'll note that the Smiths were all Irish. They're all second generation Irish,
yeah.
And so are the Beatles. You know, or some of the Beatles anyway. Yeah. Like Trinity College, where I went to college, like the Provost, is Trinity is a very good college for the humanities. It doesn't have the infrastructure or the money to compete seriously in terms of science, but they're relentlessly pushing towards science. They're relentlessly going, we're gonna be like the number one like science university in Europe. And you're like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you making yourselves into something you're not? And like, as you say, like it's kind of, it mirrors this government drive to push students towards STEM, as they call us, you know.
Right. As
and
we do too.
There's only so much STEM that people need, you know, and that's the, like, it's I don't know, I think my dad would say, like, because he was teaching kids, you know, giving them English degrees, you know, and books teach you, I think Heaney called poetry a momentary stay against confusion. So it's just like a way of just getting through things when they're difficult. And we live in a time that's more and more and more confusing, you know. And you can have, like, even if you do come out of college with your engineering degree, like, the world is so uncertain, And the companies are so powerful that, you know, you can be hired and fired at the drop of a hat. And if you happen to be, but if you happen to be a reader, then you've got something that will just, you know, through the course of your life, like help you to think your way through that, or to think in a broader sense, you know, and not just see yourself as like a cog in a machine. But increasingly, and you know, mystifyingly, we're sort of being told that, like, no, a cog, that's what you are, you know, yeah. be a good cog. Anyway.
Yeah. I'm curious about how many people in the audience have been to Ireland. Oh my goodness. Wow. That's great. How many, are there people from Ireland in our audience? Wonderful. Oh, great. Well, that's good to know. Let's switch a little bit to Paul, I heard you, everyone spoke yesterday in different panels, so Colin was in a first book panel, and Paul was at a humor and money panel that had a sort of international, both of those, and John was on one about lying, or truth, or something.
Lying.
About lying.
Well, because, of course, that's where we all are.
It's right.
It's fiction,
that's right.
We're lying.
That's right. What is it they say, that the Irish never let the truth get in the way of a good story? It's perhaps could be said about a lot of people, but Paul, when you were in your panel, you were asked about Irish, I mean specifically I think about governmental support, but so I'm interested in hearing about the Irish literary, you've all touched on it already, but publishing, festivals, there was some news in one of the newspapers this spring about the writer Donal Ryan, who is his first novel was called The Spinning Heart, wonderful sort of post-crash novel. But he made sort of news when he declared he was going back to his job, his day job, because Ireland was not supporting its writers. That's one touchstone for it. But and Paul, you said specifically about Ireland's lack of governmental support for writers, but yeah. You speak also.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to just kind of to bash Ireland all the time, like, because like it is a culture where like there are a lot of readers and like literature and words and just conversations and communication are still very important things, and like that's not the case everywhere. So I'm very, very.
Yeah, that's why I guess I was surprised to hear you say it, because I haven't. I think maybe in one way that I'm maybe guilty of romanticizing Ireland is I think of it as, you know, literary festivals every week, every season, in every region.
Well, there is that, but it's also, I mean, and like, well, I'll say with regard to Donal, like I know Donal well, and he's a very nice man. I do not know why he said that. Like, I don't know why he said that.
Okay.
Like, I think if you work as a writer or an artist of any stripe, you're not doing it for the money, you know. So like, I mean, there's no one is sort of obliged to kind of keep you. If you want to, you know, you can go and get a job or. You know, like, there are many, many centuries of starving artists, and that's just the way it rolls. But I, at the same time, I do think that the state kind of uses literature in particular, the arts in general, but literature in particular, to market itself abroad. But at the same time, doesn't have a huge amount of care or interest for the artists who actually live there. So, like I was saying yesterday, that this I may be wrong, but this composer told me recently that the government's art spend, or Ireland's art spend, is the lowest in Europe, apart from Moldova. So, like every single country in Europe is putting more money into the arts than Ireland's, and instead they're putting their money into like just like banks, like bailing out these awful banks, or putting money into like STEM, you know, and the government that we have is quite right wing and neoliberal, and they sort of see art as purely in kind of functional like terms or instrumental terms, like what money can we make from this, like how many people can be employed through art, and like if you can't prove like that you know. That more people couldn't be employed in a sandwich shop, then they'll put the money in a sandwich shop, you know. So, like I think that's, I think it's just a question of what kind of society you want. Like, I mean, Donald or Colin was talking about, like, about the Smiths and the Dole, and like how the Dole sort of created this, like, this very creative culture in England and in Ireland too. In Canada, I don't know how many people are familiar with the Canadian music scene, but it's incredibly vibrant because the government has this program whereby you can get grants to be a band, and it's very successful. And it doesn't cost much to start a writer off. Like, writers can live kind of frugally. You don't have, as I said, like, you don't need much beyond like a paper and pen. So if they want this culture of writing to survive, then they need to sort of to care about it. Just simply to care about it would be, as opposed to just just using it or seeing it as
marketing.
Marketing. Yeah.
I think actually, isn't there? And I think it's Echo and that. So didn't the Arts Council make some bizarre decision recently that, in order to get around, you had to write, or they would decide how much they would give you based on how many words you wrote. Right, you know, so to all those poor fucking poets going, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know, and then now there's a hierarchy. You've got to write prose. There's only way to make a living. You know? So I just think it echo. I think there's all sorts of these little decisions made all across the way that echo that, and you can see it. And it's quite subtle. Like, it's not like you're saying, not to be hard and saying, oh, poor us and whatever the rest of it. But there are tiny decisions made in various different bodies across the way that are marginalising it, maybe, and making it more difficult than perhaps you would like it to be or need it to be. It's different, obviously, for me, as I'm working, I have a job, it's different, so I do it. And, you know, if the book doesn't sell a copy, and doesn't really make much difference to me, you know, I've got a tiny advance from my publisher and I keep working and do my job. So, but if you are somebody who is trying to carve a living out of it, you know, you would like to see it being, you know, supported in a better way, you know, and not being judged on these numerical things like how many jobs is it, or how many words have you written. But I think, and I'd agree again with Paul, we have quite neoliberal kind of right-wing government, and I think that is the way that they assess things. And that's, we said it earlier today, I think that you know, arts and the humanities are being marginalised and are being pushed out because education is seen not as education, but it's seen as something that's serving industry, and that's its purpose. And all of these small decisions are a product of that way of thinking. And I don't think they help.
I told you guys I was going to ask this. You may have noticed that we have a lot of men on our panel.
A manel.
One of us isn't.
So I warned them that I was going to ask them to tell us about, because I have heard that there are women writers in Ireland, to tell us about who's coming along in the footsteps. We mentioned Edna O'Brien in the program, and I'll put in a plug for her latest novel, which I thought was really wonderful, returning to the west of Ireland and going to London and elsewhere. But who can you tell our audience about?
I'll start. No, yeah, I feel like some of my best friends are women. You know, it's like, I'm gonna tell you. No, there are tons of really fantastic. Some of the best new Irish writers are in fact female, and I mean, I can just stick to my home county, Mayo, with its population of 40,000 people. There's woman, Liz Reapy, E.M. Reapy. She wrote her first book under, it's called Red Dirt, and it's about backpackers in Australia getting into serious trouble. Came out last year, and I only got to read it, like, you know, quite a bit after it came out, but it's a fantastic book, and she's um, she's kind of a good, like, you get these people in Ireland. She ran a kind of a, essentially a semi-regularly anthology for young writers.
Can you say her name one more time?
Well, Elizabeth Reapy, E.M. Reapy, she writes under, so E.M. Reapy. And Red Dirt was the book. And no, she's just one of these people. I mean, she's in around my age, younger, early 30s, and she ran a literary series and readings up in Dublin. Never had any money or arts council money or anything, but still got lots of people involved. And so she's always been one of those sort of engines of productivity. Anyway, her book is excellent. And another one that came out just recently is by Sally Rooney, her name is, and she's like 25 or something, and it's an incredibly accomplished first book, Conversations with Friends, it's called. And she's from Castlebar, she's from up the road from me, I met her in Dublin in the last couple of years, and she's had a few short stories published, and is a super talented, super intelligent person and writer. So Conversations with Friends is great. And that's just Mayo. I mean, I could go on, but I'm sure the lads are will say more.
Do you want to just list Irish?
Well, throw some names out. Yeah, tell us.
Obviously, you have Emma Donoghue, Sarah Baum, people like
Sarah Baum was here last year. Yeah.
All right, yeah. There's Eamonn McBride. I haven't read all the work, but I know they're there. And in fact, I know they're. And I think Colin alluded to it. I think they're more. There seems to be more women, in fact, than men in some ways.
We die younger. So
we do. Yeah. We got to give it all early, and yeah, get as much as that. Obviously there is. They're all there, and as was alluded to earlier as well. There did seem to be that period of kind of, you know, 6, 7, 8 years where nothing was coming out, and then there's this kind of explosion, and then there's the kind of the older names, I suppose, that of other writers that are kind of sitting there, and you've mentioned Edna O'Brien, and so there's a whole, you know, there's a whole host of them, and
There's a great publishing house called Tramp Press, which is run by two women called Sarah Davis-Goff and Lisa Cohen, and they set up this publishing house themselves, and they're just like dynamos. They published Sarah Baum's book, Spill, Simmer, Fall Weather, and they did it with like very little resources, but just such a brilliant job. They traveled.
It's a wonderful book.
Yeah,
and, but wonderful those, book. Those she guys, was here last year on the panel. Yeah.
They really made that book. I mean, they traveled like all around Ireland, all around like Europe with her, and just were relentless in getting that book out there and getting into people's hands. And I think that they're really they're just super smart people, like very talented and very very just very very driven. And I think that they're sort of opening doors then for new kind of women writers. I mean, like not exclusively women writers though.
Right, right.
But that's a really exciting
Tramp Press.
Yep.
Okay, because I read the American version of that. Great. Well, I think we will open up for questions from our well-traveled, well-read audience. And people will come around with microphones for you, and they'll hold them for you because they're recording for a podcast. So if you would like to ask a question, raise your hand and our assistants, or I will pick on them. Okay, so, you, sir. Sir.
Don't you have a new prime minister who is the kind of a different sort of character than more usual politicians? And do you have any thoughts about that?
No, he's exactly the same. He just has a different face.
Yeah.
Oh, sir, that's my take. The last might have more to contribute to that.
Well, we have a president who's a poet. Michael D. Higgins is a poet, and he's a great guy. I really admire him immensely. Like he's a proper poet. Like he's a good poet, and he's also a really courageous guy who's really interested in just all of the right things, like just compassion and ethics. And he's often like at variance with the government because like he'll go abroad, and make some sort of statement about like how about China's human rights record or whatever, and the government will just you can hear the face plant from across the waves because they'll be going, oh please China, come to us, and like no, we're not going to bother you about that stuff. So he's a great guy to have, and I think we're very lucky to have him. Yeah.
And I know you had a question also. They have to hold it for you. Oh. Yeah, it's a rule.
I was in Shanghai for the first Chinese International Expo.
The mic is not working.
I was in Shanghai, China, for the first International Expo. It's about the time period that you're saying Ireland is on the rise because it was lots of trade. And I was extraordinarily impressed because Ireland was the only country that had in its exposition poets as its export.
Wow.
And every week there was a delegation of poets. Everybody who entered the exposition out in the fair were given sheets of poetry by the poets.
Wow.
And so I was introduced to so many Irish writers. It was a very small group of Irish people came here for the most part. But they were mostly from Cork. And along with them was Colm Tóibín, who was judging the first International Booker Award, which was given to a Chinese. So this was an extraordinary revelation for me, because these were writers that whose books were not distributed here. And I heard Sarah Baum last year, and there was a big task in getting her book into our market. So my conclusion was that the Irish, which is what you're saying, writers would say things that other writers cannot say or will not say or would not ever reveal about their lives or their pains or their sorrows or themselves in this age, the 21st century. And the courage of it and the humanity of it was just extraordinary. So I guess the question is, because I met the Cork writers, and Colin has singled out his village, his town. Do you want to comment on the Cork constituency?
Unless you feel that hand grenade. Cork is superb.
Or has
the government
Cork people
changed since then?
Are known to have a superiority complex.
Of course, there was a bunch of people from Cork over in Shanghai handing out their leaflets of poetry at a goddamn expo.
I don't know who was behind that, but I guarantee
we're the best.
Somebody from Cork was in charge of that event. They said that, like, these, you know, they won't acknowledge Dublin exists. You know, it's just so.
My favorite Cork joke is the woman on the beach in Skibbereen saying, "Help, my son, the engineer is drowning."
it does have a lot of poets, Cork. Yeah, some places in Ireland are funny like that. Mayo, where I'm from, yeah, it's really rural. It's north of Galway, like, and it has, you know, its biggest town is still very small. And as I say, it's 40,000 people. It's, you know, it's crap land, crap farmland. Traditionally, everyone leaves, but there's like about 10,000 writers in it there, you know, and like. Paul mentioned Tramp Press. Lisa Cohn is from Mayo, and they've helped sort of revive the career of a fantastic, again, Mayo Irish writer, Mike McCormack, a book called Solar Bones, which is an amazing piece of work. And he writes very experimental, like he writes actually, you know, genuinely genre blending experimental fiction, like heavily modernistly influenced, and like it's like, as Mike himself says, it's like J.G. Ballard in Westport, and you know, so it's very strange stuff. And when he was with like more conventional UK publishers, you know, they hadn't a clue how to position him, because it wasn't like McGahern or, you know, it didn't fit into, you know, kind of easier conceptions of what Irish writing is. And but they, again, like Tramp have helped revive him, and completely deservedly. And it won the Goldsmiths Prize for Innovative Fiction in the UK, and the UK have gone mental again from. So he's enjoying that, and it's well deserved. But no, some towns are like that. Cork has a lot of poets. I mean, I've been down a few times to festivals and stuff there, and they get a lot of poets for some reason. And like Belfast is the same in the north. I went up there. I went up to do a reading a couple of years back, and I met a young writer from Belfast, Mick Nolan, and he writes. He writes fiction, and he came to my reading with three people at it. It was one of these readings. There's three of us reading. There's, you know, seven people in the crowd, and he goes, you know, he's like, "Oh, you're great," and he's like, "Oh, yeah, yeah." And I was like, I was very very small turnout, a bit surprised. You know, I wasn't surprised, it's fine. But he was like, ah, yeah, no, no, this place, it's a poet's town, man. The poets. It's like, if you were up here now doing a sonnet, fucking place would be packed out. Like, he was just like, it's a poet's town. So, Cork's a bit like that as well, I think.
And a question here in the front row?
Hi. When I was in Ireland, I noticed a little effort to revive Irish language, and I was wondering if there is anyone writing in Irish.
Good question.
I do Talkie Archive Press publish my books. They're actually an American publisher, but with offices in Dublin, and they have done a couple of dual language books where they were written originally in Irish, but they have the Irish on one page and then they have the English on the other page. You can kind of compare it. Again, but like a lot of the Dawkey books, there's quite experimental stuff, even in Irish and that stuff. And my father is an Irish teacher, and you know, and he looked at it and he went, that's a nice challenge and stuff. Now, it's not the sort of thing that you would give to 17 or 18 year old in school to read, like, but there are a couple, and publishing them can be the difficult part, but there are a couple of people publishing in Irish, and then there's a few people who would publish in both languages. I think the poet Eilish Ní Gaoimhne writes in both. It is certainly happening on a smaller scale, I suppose, and that's probably the business side of it coming into it. People looking at, well, how many of these can I actually sell? But there is a cultural thing that doesn't necessarily define its value, so it does happen.
I'm Catherine.
Yeah. One of you might answer a question I have about the upsurge of screenwriting and Irish writers in the movies. We had, of course, Emma Donoghue and Colm Tobin as Oscar nominees last year. And so where's all that going?
Well, Paul has a screenplay, has a film that's going to be in production this...
Touch wood. Yeah, it should be... Yeah, hopefully next week it's going to start pre-production.
Is it called Touchwood, or do you just say Touchwood?
No, it's not. It's not called Touchwood. That's actually a better title than that. We should talk. Who is this guy? I like this kid. That's the result of like the film board. I think film was funded quite cleverly over a number of years, and a lot of really talented people kind of have come through as a result of that. So people like Lenny Abrahamson, who directed Room and like many other like fantastic films, and you know, like Martin McDonagh, and who directed the Guard, was that
isn't that his brother?
His brother.
Yeah.
And like John Carney, and like these guys have had huge successes, and I think that's because of this, that they have, that's a place where the government has done a good job of funding the arts. What I hear is that they want to change the model to make it more commercial. So instead of to use the unfortunate neologism, growing careers, you know, sort of taking someone who's just starting off and giving them sort of the space and the resources to kind of like make a short film and then make like a small film for not much money and so forth, and develop their skills and develop their talents. Instead of doing that, I hear that they're pivoting towards like just getting foreign companies to come to Ireland and make a film and give us money and then push off again. So again, it's like sort of the short term, there's a kind of like short term thinking that, and if that's the case, then you won't have like a new Lenny Abrahamson coming through, you know, because there won't be the same.
And just a little extra part of that. The other day you were talking about your experience and the difference in the medium for you and how big a challenge it is to switch over into screenwriting and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that... I like writing dialogue. I think like a lot of Irish writers like writing dialogue because it's just a place where people, as you've seen, like talk a lot, you know. And I thought when writing a screenplay, you could just... It's nothing but dialogue. So, you know, this is the easiest thing in the world. I'll just have, you know, two people yammering back and forth for... I discovered that from a filmmaker's point of view, there's almost always too much dialogue. You know, if there was no dialogue at all, like for most filmmakers, that would be about the right amount of dialogue. You know, if someone is talking, then like it's because you haven't found a way to visualize what's happening. You know, so I found it like very, very difficult. And also, it's films are like they're incredibly structured and plotty. Like they're all about plot. And so this is very, very rigorous. I'm trying to say structure again, but it's this kind of like the three act structure is very, very rigorously adhered to, and the plot has to be like very, very, very tight. And if you work as a novelist, like novelists hate plots. Like plots are, you know, it's dreadful, awful things that you're kind of saddled with, you know. And a lot of writers will just make a gesture towards the plot so they can do the stuff that they're interested in, which is, you know, like the, you know, the dialogue or like writing about like the sunset or whatever it might be. But in film, like you know, you've got to have it like every single scene, every single moment has to be there for a reason, which I found quite oppressive.
Yeah. We've got another question here.
Hi. When I was in Ireland, I spent some time studying gender in Irish history, and then came back and studied in the U.S., sort of gender in the Irish diaspora in the U.S., as you were speaking about things that may be on your mind in Ireland about Trump, whether you are yourselves in the diaspora currently, not currently living in Ireland, your voices are just very valuable to me in these times where Heaney might say that hope and history don't necessarily rhyme. I was wondering what you, as people involved in developing Irish masculinity, both at home and in the diaspora, sort of what's on your mind in terms of masculinity these days as Irish men?
Yeah, that's a tough one. My book is short stories. I mean, most of the characters are young male, you know, guys. And you know, all the main characters, and you know that's what it's about. I was aware of that when I was writing it, and I, you know, tried to write a few stories with female characters at their center, but they weren't working out for, you know, due to my own shortcomings. But I suppose it is something you have to. It's something I'm aware of. You know, it is something. Deflect the question, but like, you know, you don't sit down and go, I'm going to dissect Irish masculinity, or I'm going to I think just, you know, the larger cultural discussion, intersectionality and so forth, you know, it's there. It's something you have to just try and incorporate, try and think about, and if you have something interesting to say about it, you know, say it. But I don't know. Most of the reviews of my book are like, this is a depiction of contemporary Irish masculinity, or it's a condemnation of it, or a kind of, you know, and like post-recession Ireland. And again, it's these big ideas, you know, that were there. They're there in the cultural context when you're writing. And it probably has all. It undoubtedly fed into the book, but not consciously. You know, they're never the concerns. You know, the things that people end up finding the most fruitful to talk about as a writer. I think it's like, they're not front and center, you know, when you're writing about it. So,
but Colin, you have been vocal, and you've written about domestic violence in Ireland. I mean, I believe. I think maybe it's not in the same academic terms, but it seems to be something that you are.
Well, it's just, yeah. I mean, it was you know, horrific case of a man who murdered his family, and you know, but because he was a middle, and killed himself because he's a middle class principal or vice principal, and you know, and what happens is, you know, journalists go down and they start talking to all these traumatized people in Cavan, and they say what people who are traumatized and aren't, you know, you know, violent crime experts do. They say, oh, well, he was a lovely man and everything was great. So you just got these essential, these hagiographies about this guy who literally just killed his family. That many, you know, you look, tabloid journalists, The Sun, The Irish, and you're not expecting anything better. But even the Irish Times and stuff, they were very reticent to talk about what is overwhelmingly obviously the thing you need to talk about out of it. And I did write a thing and about it, you know, and about domestic abuse. And I had no special insight. It's just this is, you know, this you know, the completely unenlightening cliche that was the mainstream Irish narrative about this murder suicide was, it was this inexplicable, he must have had a break or something. And you're like, well, no, the literature, if you read it, is domestic abuse is a pattern, and when this is usually the culminating act of something. It's not even about introducing this guy, you know, but it's about having a discussion centering it on that. As actually Sally Rooney pointed out just in a tweet about it, every article in the papers that was, you know, about this man who murdered his children, 3 children and his wife, was accompanied by a, if you've been affected by this article, there was a suicide hotline, but there was nothing about domestic violence. So I wrote a thing about it, the Irish Times wouldn't run it because they thought it was too
provocative.
Yeah, my contact in there did like it, but yeah, he put it higher up the food chain. Like, we don't do speculative pieces, and I said, "Well, you do speculative pieces. You're speculating." He had a random break, and you know, was normal one day and wasn't the next. So, you know, yeah, and that was a non-fiction piece I wrote, and I was just. Granted, took it in the UK, and it had a good response. And there was a few other people wrote some pieces, but again, it's like the Guardian ran an article on it in the UK. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing in the mainstream Irish media. So, if you're middle class, you know, white lad who, you know, murders your family, they just say you're great. You know.
Yeah. So. Well, we'll take one more question. This woman here in the white, sorry, and we'll have to just if you have other questions, please. Join the writers at the signing table, and you can ask your individual question there. So, sorry to cut off others who wanted to.
Going back to your earlier question as to why Ireland produced so many writers, in the 1960s, I visited my cousins in County Mayo, and the main form of entertainment was oral history, storytelling in the pubs, the snug, each home. Is that still prevalent in Ireland today?
Hmm. I don't know if the story... telling in the same order, but there's certainly the pub is still very important important ritual, drinking in the pub. So we were doing that last night, and Colin and I were doing that, and just like drinking, telling stories, and I think that's like, I think, as I said, like it's kind of, I think it's definitely still a place where people go out, you know, in England. I remember, like, I went to college I did a master's in Norwich, which is about 2 hours outside of London. And, like in Dublin, like, a lot of the time, the problem is when you go, like, all the pubs are full. You'd go to all the pubs, and there's not room to fit in the door. But when you'd go out in Norwich, like, the problem would be the opposite. Like, all the pubs are empty, and you'd look in the door and go, oh, Jesus, there's literally no one there. We'll try the next place. And, like, the barman, they're sort of forlornly polishing the... Going, like, come on in, lads. Come on in. So which is to say that, like, the UK is a place where, and I think, like, it's a place to certain parts of the States as well. I guess I don't know the States super well, but just from friends who do live in different parts of the US, people just, they go to work and they go home and they watch Netflix all night, you know, and like that's fine. But in Ireland, like, it's. People will still sort of go out and talk to each other, and I think that's really, quite aside from, like, you know, the benefits to literature of that. Like, I just think just the benefits to your health, just as a human being, to go, like, leave your house and talk to another human being face to face is it's good for you. It's a good thing to do. Yeah, I remember reading an article recently about a doctor talking about. If you're obese and you smoke 10 cigarettes a day and you drink 3 beers a day and you've no friends, the healthiest thing you can do is make a friend. That's the best thing you can do.
So. Well, that's a nice note to end on, I think. Please join us outside. The books are for sale there, and you can get them signed. And I'm Catherine Barry is here, and I'd actually like to just give you 1 minute to tell everyone about the Listowel Los Gatos Writers Week, because if you're interested in Irish literature, you want to know about this event in October.
Okay, hi, my name is Catherine Barry, and I founded an Irish... festival that's coming up in October. I have some postcards here. I'm happy to hand them out so you can mark your calendars. We had 14 writers from Ireland last year, and it's...
You had Mike McCormick. We had Mike...
So we have our finger on the pulse. We've got the emerging guys. And we'd love to see some of you. I know it's a bit of a hike to Los Gatos from here, but it's a nice day out, lovely town, and it's a charming place to have a writers' festival. And it's twinned with Listowel in Ireland. Many of you might know there's a very prestigious international writers' festival on it right now. So the towns have been sister cities for 20 years, so it's the perfect place to kind of replicate and do a little micro version of this amazing festival. So yeah, come and get a postcard, and we'd love to see you there. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.